on VOA 1, the hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories on today's program. First, the education report. Alice Bryant talks about older teachers and their decision to keep on teaching during the coronavirus pandemic. Then Jonathan Evans tells us about the future of business travel. I will return with words and their stories. We will end our program with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
At the age of 86, agriculture teacher Gerald Bonds has seen plenty of crises during his career. He sees no reason to leave the profession over the coronavirus crisis. Bonds is in his 58th year of teaching at Farmington High School in Farmington, New Mexico. And like most teachers in his state, he has been instructing his students at home, which he truly dislikes. I hate it. I want to see the students face to face and talk to them, Bonds told reporters with the Associated Press. Some teachers have retired early or taken leave because of the difficulties of distance learning and the health risks of in-person teaching. But many longtime instructors, like Bonds, are choosing to stay. The states of New Mexico and Maine have the oldest teachers in the country, with 1 in 4 older than 55. That information comes from a 2018 study of teachers and school leaders by the National Center for Education Statistics. Almost 6% of New Mexico's educators are 65 or older, notes the New Mexico Public Education Department. With few exceptions, New Mexico schools have been providing only distance learning. So far, this has saved many teachers from dealing with the health risks of being in classrooms with students. Ryan Stewart is the New Mexico Education Secretary. He told the AP his state is making health and safety number one. Teachers whose health puts them at a high risk can ask for low contact or no contact teaching work, he said. For some parts of the state, this will cause a shortage of teachers and make it harder to return to in-person learning, he noted. Bonds said other teachers are assisting him with some distance learning duties. For example, they help him put his lesson plans online and set up video conferencing. But he says it is still hard to teach students about raising animals and growing plants without in-person involvement. Let's get through this and get back to person-to-person classes. I think that's important because I think these young people are going through a lot of emotional things right now, Bond said. Spanish teacher Manuel Acosta is 71 years old. He teaches at Hobbs High School in southeastern New Mexico. He thinks of video conferencing as just the latest in a long line of teaching tools for from chalk to email. He plans to teach remotely until the public health crisis is over. He says he will do so even if some of his students start attending school in person. Acosta was excused from in-person teaching after getting a medical device for his heart in March. His 86-year-old mother, who lives separately, was also a reason. A home health aide cares for her during the week, and Acosta visits her less often. But he still buys food and other things for her and visits every weekend. And he still wants to teach, even if it cannot be in person. He has spent 46 years serving students across half of the state's rural areas. "I enjoy teaching. I enjoy the interaction with the students," said Acosta. "I don't know anything else." I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, here is Jonathan Evans.
Brian Contreras represents the worst fears of the profitable business travel industry. Contreras is an account executive at an American technology company. He is used to traveling often for work. But now, he and thousands of others are working from home and calling into video meetings instead of getting on planes. Contreras manages his North American accounts from Sacramento, California. He does not expect to travel for work again until the middle of 2021. Even then, he is not sure how much he will need to. "Maybe it's just the acceptance of the new normal. I have all of the resources necessary to be on the calls, all of the communicative devices to make sure I can do my job," he said. That situation could mean big trouble for hotels, airlines, meeting centers, and other industries that depend so heavily on business travelers like Contreras. Work travel represented 21% of the $8.9 trillion spent on worldwide travel and tourism in 2019. That information comes from the World Travel and Tourism Council. Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian recently suggested business travel might settle into a new normal that is 10 to 20% lower than it used to be. He told the Associated Press, "I do think corporate travel is going to come back faster than people suspect. I just don't know if it will come back to the full volume." Right now, Delta's business travel income is down 85%. Mazen Hayek is the spokesman for MBC Group in Dubai. The media organization operates 18 television stations. Hayek says it is unlikely employees will travel as often once the coronavirus crisis ends because they have proven they do not need to. MBC has reduced trips by more than 85%. Hayek said. American technology company Amazon told its employees to stop traveling in March. It says the move has saved nearly $1 billion in travel costs so far this year. Amazon is the second largest employer in the U.S., with more than 1.1 million employees. Gary Kelly is the CEO at Southwest Airlines. He said money from business travel, which normally makes up more than one-third of Southwest's business, is down 90%. Peter Bellababa teaches airline management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He said business travel is down partly because some people are afraid to fly. But he adds that companies also fear being held responsible if employees are infected with COVID-19 while traveling for work. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Those who want to travel may also be limited by travel restrictions, Bellababa added. The decrease in travel has been very good for teleconferencing services. Zoom said 370,200 businesses with at least 10 employees had signed up for its service by the end of July. That is more than three times the number it had at the end of April. But for some workers, teleconferencing cannot replace being there in person. Rebecca Lindland is an automotive advisor and founder of Rebecca Drives. She used to travel 38 weeks each year for test drives and auto shows. This year, she did not fly from March until September. Test drives have been cut back to regional events, so attendees do not have to travel as far. Lindland says she is confident she can return to air travel safely. She wears a face covering and says that even before the pandemic, she always carried disinfectant products. Sam Clark is an assistant professor in the College of Business at California State University, San Marcos. He agrees that some in-person events, like trade shows, will still be important in the future. But he thinks new kinds of business travel could also develop. Clark also expects some companies to change their travel policies. For example, he said companies could decide to let most employees work from home and then fly them all back to headquarters once a year. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and sayings in American English a little deeper. Today, we talk about fire. Any kind of fire, from a campfire to a lit match, gives off smoke. This fact about fire relates to today's idiom. There is no smoke without fire. Before we continue, let's talk about two words often used to explain this idiom: rumor and gossip. Rumors and gossip are stories or pieces of information that are passed from person to person, but have not been proven to be true. They are often about something bad. One meaning of there's no smoke without fire is that rumors and gossip often have some truth behind them. If the word on the street is that something is really bad, it just might be. Or if you hear unpleasant things about someone or something from many different people, there may be some truth to it. Maybe. Here's an example.
I think we should start looking for another job. I've heard that this bank is going under. It could just be gossip, but usually there's no smoke without fire.
In other words, there must be at least some truth to all the talk. The logic is this. If many people are saying that something bad is happening, it could be partly true. We say this idiom several ways. You can say, there's no smoke without fire, or you can say, where there's smoke, there's fire. You can even simply say, where there's smoke, without finishing the rest of the sentence. People will definitely understand your meaning. Here is another example.
Hey, I hear you're going out with that new guy at work.
We went for a long walk together. That's about it.
Well, be careful. Rumor has it that he is bad news.
What kind of bad news?
Well, he's been married before.
So, there's no crime against having a marriage that didn't work out.
Right. But he's been married 4 times. My cousin knows a former wife of his. She says the guy owes money all over town.
This is all just gossip.
Look, I'm just saying be careful. Where there's smoke, yeah, you know.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well-trained and well-supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders: break off the fight, return to Chancellorsville, put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville, but he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. The Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us. And fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union Army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men. More and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.